Bob, is anyone there? This is Doug Isaacson.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Bob is away
from the
microphone at the moment. Hi, Doug.
Hi, who's this?
This is Liz Morin, I believe Representative Nagak is to my left here. He's at the microphone also.
Oh, excellent.
Thanks for joining us on the phone.
You bet. It was so quiet, I didn't think anyone
How are
was
you?
There.
Over here.
Bob. Hey, Benny.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. I didn't hear anyone talking, so I thought I was in a ghost room.
I can barely hear you now.
Oh, you can't hear me?
There.
Can you hear me now? Yeah.
There are people talking.
Oh, okay. Well, it's good. Good. I guess Rep Newman was in your neck of the woods here this last weekend as well.
Yeah. And Lance was there too.
Well, very good. You've been having a busy summer legislatively.
Oh, so far.
Well, good.
Hey, Bob.
Is Doug on the line?
Oh. I'm here, Bob.
Right there.
So, how's the water levels around North Pole?
It's flooding into my basement right now.
Oh, no, that's not good.
No. But that just gives another picture, right?
So the positive, the upside of that is the fire season is washed out?
For the moment, we have air that we can breathe. That's correct.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, actually.
In charge.
I'm used to Bob being in charge, though.
Stuff here. She was in the legislation.
You are.
All right, I think we're ready to get started this morning. I think we'll take a minute to introduce commissioners here. And before we do that, though, my name is Elizabeth Moore. I am the Alaska Native Corporation representative on the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, but I want to turn it over to our co-chair, Representative Herron, this morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Liz. And it's a pleasure to be here to listen and learn, and to Liz and Reggie. Appreciate you calling this meeting, and look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Nagak.
Thank you. It's fortuitous that we're here today after a dismal whaling season. Well, we got whales, but the conditions were warranted there. It was dangerous. It's not like it was when I was growing up. It's a whole complete new Arctic that we have. And I just came from Barrow yesterday, and the ice is so thin, the lead is just so close, but they can't go. There's a lot of oog, so what they're doing is they're pulling or pushing their boats right into the lead, about a couple hundred yards. We're 100 yards away from the shore. So that's a new Arctic we have, and I'm glad I'm here. Thank you.
Hi, this is Nils Andreas, and I'm the Executive Director of the Institute of the North and representing international Arctic organizations on the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Reggie Jewell, and I sit on a tribal representative seat on the commission. and I am from Kotzebue.
Great. I also wanted to have staff, if you could stand up and show yourselves to the folks in the room, that'd be great. I think Nikush, you're here. Nikush is our executive director, so if you have questions for any of us or Nikush, you're welcome to ask, and there's other staff in the room as well. I really want to thank everyone for coming today. The Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, I think Mayor Jewell and myself felt that it would be good to have another listening session to provide another opportunity to for folks to provide comments, not only on the preliminary report, but other thoughts on Alaska's Arctic policy. So I also want to take a second and let folks on the phone introduce themselves. I think we have Representative Isaacson, if you want to start us off.
Thank you. This is Representative Doug Isaacson from North Pole, and I'm just glad to be able to listen in. I'm very interested in Arctic development and see it as our future and the need for us to be united on our vision and our path forward is important. So thank you for convening this meeting today.
Hi, this is Representative David Guttenberg from Fairbanks to Hooper Bay.
Thank you both for joining us. We also have Ukalesak. Can you introduce yourself?
Uvlalotuk, can you hear me?
Yes.
Uvlalotuk, everybody. My name is Ukalesak, Executive Director at Native Village of Kotzebue.
Thank you for joining us, Ukalesak. And Art Ivanov. Art, can you introduce yourself real quick?
Art Ivanov, Barents Sea Alliance, LLC, Unalakleet.
Great. Have I missed anyone else on the line?
Liz, this is Chris Norris. I'm from Petersburg and part of the commission.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. Good to hear you. So with that, I think we can go ahead and get started. I'm going to ask, do we have anyone in the room who would like to make comments this morning? No? All right. Sorry. I think we're just here to listen and take comments from the audience and anyone who's joining us on the line.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. You know, we came out, the Arctic Policy, Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, came out under the leadership of Representative Heron and Senator McGuire with a very aggressive schedule to try and put a Alaska Arctic policy framework together, given that, you know, the discussions around the Arctic and the interest of the Arctic has accelerated tremendously, and what used to be something and a topic that was out in the future, actually, that future is here. And so... in January, February, the commission came out with a preliminary report, and so that's been out there for a while. And part of this, and the final draft, Chairman Heron, I believe, is due next legislative session, or the final recommendations are due next legislative session. So this gives us the opportunity during the interim to get some feedback from people about the different aspects of this report. And while we may not be able to cover all aspects and get everybody's issues in, I think it at least gives us the opportunity to put this out to public hearing and get some feedback. So I think with that, we are here to kind of listen to folks on their read and what they see as opportunities and challenges in the preliminary report.
So, Reggie, what you're saying is anybody that attended this meeting, either on teleconference or in the room, is required to make comment to you and Liz?
Not required. And there's been several. I just want to say there's been several. You know, there's been different focuses, whether it's been on climate change or economic development. And certainly there are many publics in Alaska. And including people who live in the Arctic, people in rural Alaska, the Alaska Native people, tribal people. And we have, I think, probably a lot of discussion and debate about what the Arctic should look like, who lives in the Arctic. Is the Arctic consistent of all of Alaska? Is it anything north of the Arctic Circle? What is it? And if you look at the executive summary that's been provided in the back, you'll see a red line running through Alaska that shows the Arctic Council, an international definition of what the Arctic consists of, at least in Alaska. So thank you for all of that.
Well, if we don't have, did you want to come up and speak? Okay.
Good morning, and thanks for allowing me to address this body. Air Jewel, nice to see you again. Yeah. My name is Jack O'Milek. I'm here representing several agencies. I'm the U.S. co-chair on the U.S.-Russia Bilateral Commission. I'm also the executive director of the Alaska Nanuk Commission, and then also here representing the Arctic Marine Mammal Coalition. The reason I'm here is to talk about all of our interests in the impending increased Arctic shipping. I don't have a prescription for you in regards to the report that was delivered. This is mainly to inform this body of our actions and our goals. The Arctic Marine Mammal Coalition is made up of five of the Arctic co-management bodies, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, Alaska Nanuk Commission, the Beluga Whale Committee, Eskimo Walrus Commission, and the Ice Seal Committee. I read in the paper a couple of days ago that the Northwest Arctic Borough, City of Nome, were invited and accepted to begin a partnership with the North Slope Borough in the formation of a waterway safety committee. This is something that the Arctic Marine Mammal Coalition and, of course, the Alaska Nanuk Commission has been involved in since 2012. That was the first time we came together. We knew it was important that as co-management agencies representing the federal government that we come together to form this coalition to advocate on behalf of subsistence marine mammal hunters. At that time, the more popular thing was gearing up to provide response, rescue, hazard mitigation for the impending shipping traffic. It didn't seem like there was enough, interest in advocating for continued subsistence marine mammal use. So that's one of the reasons why we formed. As most of you know, we felt it was imperative that it was just the Arctic Marine Mammal co-management agencies. We've got our own unique challenges and problems with the Arctic. We wanted to sort of separate ourselves from the other co-management groups that don't deal with Arctic issues. Food security is our number one issue, and I really don't like reading from notes, so I'd like to provide this body a copy electronic copy if that's better. But there are some key points here that I've been asked to relay to you, so I want to make sure that I get those right. We also have observers from the North Slope Borough that make up the AMMC, Kuwerik, Inuit Circumpolar Council. And what we're trying to do is work more closely with the science community, regulators, and industry to understand the current and potential impacts to the Arctic marine mammals and the subsistence users in regards to increasing levels of maritime traffic. So one of the things that we accomplished in our last meeting, which I believe was in February, was the AMMC decided to begin the process of developing a waterway safety committee. We've got great support from the U.S. Coast Guard. We will be meeting in August in Juneau with the director, Ed Page, who is going to sort of provide us information on the next steps of forming this Harbor Safety Committee. We felt it was important that the AMMC take the lead role and decide that this Water Safety Committee was important quite some time ago, because we felt that if subsistence marine mammal users sort of set up the Waterway Safety Committee, we could at least ensure seats at the table for those people that we represent. So I appreciate the time, and if you have any, I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah, ma'am. A couple of years ago, we had a meeting in Maine, the group made a declaration at that time, and if you could state what you know of that declaration that you made because of the concerns that we have in terms of shipping and a lot of ocean traffic going through the Northwest Passage where our indigenous people depend on marine mammals for their sustenance.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gack. One of the things we did when we engaged the U.S. Coast Guard, like I said, at that time there was little advocacy for subsistence marine mammal users. And politics aside, we were looking, we had worked hard to identify the process in which we could provide substantial and relevant comment into the U.S. Coast Guard port access route studies. So one of the things that the body did at that meeting was identify 11 issues that were important to marine mammal users of the Arctic in regards to increased traffic shipping. And I'll include that submission public comment when I provide this body with the electronic copy. But in summary, some of the things that we were concerned about was the proximity, of course, of the increased traffic in regards to the hunting areas of St. Lawrence Island. At our last meeting in February, we also met with other federal agencies, and we believe we spurred the Coast Guard through our federal legislators to begin mapping the eastern portion of St. Lawrence Island, which will help this traffic that's unmapped so far. It is a shorter route, and it will also benefit our subsistence users on St. Lawrence Island because we won't have traffic going through their hunting grounds. We also asked that they establish and adhere to speed limits within proximity of St. Lawrence Island, and requested that they help us initiate a substantial plan when it comes to oil spill response. So just an example, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, in regards to polar bears, the oil spill response was developed in 97 and was recently just updated with no new information and no detailed plan of response. So issues like that are what we identified. That's absolutely critical. How are we going to respond to any type of oil spill or hazard? And like I said, I'll provide that those 11 points of issues for us, but also we made prescriptions, which was received very well by the federal agencies, because too often, as we know, it's more difficult to provide solutions than it is problems.
On that point, Liz, so you say it was updated, but with no information and no plan, so maybe there's not an official response to your inquiries of what the heck. So what was the conversation privately with individuals with Fish and Wildlife and anybody in the federal government as to why there wasn't real information in the update?
Well, I'm fortunate to be a part of those meetings that draft up that oil spill response plan. Quite frankly, there just isn't enough sort of, I guess, activity, history, precedents, whatever it is, to understand how hazards or oil spills occur in the Arctic. So without sort of that background or information, along with, of course, not enough federal money dedicated to understanding how those things work, it's merely, there's, like I said, there's not a whole lot of information, let alone new or critical evaluation. So one of the difficult things is we've got, three or four agencies at a time, whether it be federal, state, or international, that are creating, oil spill response or hazard mitigation plans. And it's difficult for people in the villages who are, often the first people to respond or react to these things to figure out who even to call. Who's got jurisdiction, who's responsible for what. So, of course, it's easy, a more coordinated effort, on these things. And, too often some of these oil spill response hazard mitigation plans are merely procedural and rarely lack any substance to when it comes time to put boots on the ground. There's no detailed plan of action.
Are there any other questions from commissioners online or up here? No. Thank you.
Thanks. See you, Jay.
Lalo, can you hear me?
Yes. I was actually about to call on you, Ugalesak. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, commissioners. My name is Ukulesak. I'm the executive director at the Native Village of Kotzebue, and I do have a few comments I'd like to share. Before I go on, can everyone hear me okay?
Yep, we can.
Okay.
Yeah, you're fine. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Thank you. Well, looking at your draft report, I think there's a lot of great recommendations that are made in the report itself, and I just want to echo support for many things that are said in there. For the tribe, some of our priorities include Anupac language revitalization. In fact, the Native Village of Kotzebue operates the only Anupac immersion school in the United States, and that has been in operation since 1998, and it's an important piece, I think, to lead revitalization because our language is changing and it is in need of of policy support from a council or commission such as yours to strengthen that in the Arctic. When the report talks about globalization of the Arctic, I think it's important that we know who we are and that our cultures of the Arctic are important to contribute to the diversity and richness of knowing and understanding the Arctic. And supporting language revitalization is a key piece of maintaining that identity of the Arctic. And I want to mention that to commissioners. You know, that's a very real activity that can be done by many Arctic communities. And related to that is subsistence, or really our way of life. And it is recognized, I think, well in the plan that we have to sustain that way of life no matter what the changes are. That is a very proud way of life for our people here. And it's a way of life that is very connected to our Arctic environment and understands that environment and continues to inform research and changes of the Arctic. So supporting subsistence is a way of supporting information for climate change, for research, and for understanding the environment and the ecosystems of the Arctic. And related to that, I think it's important to look at decolonization. I don't know if that's something that was mentioned in your report, but the colonization of the Arctic is an outmoded system. And we have to look at, when you look at resource development, that colonization model should not be the model that is used. There needs to be a support for decolonization of our communities, decolonization of state agencies, of federal agencies, and of various people when they operate in the Arctic. The Arctic is one of the last pieces or places in the world that experience colonization, primarily because of the cold and so forth. But that colonization has happened very rapidly. And, you know, the cultural, social, economic impacts to our communities is very, very real. And so I think it's important for all of you, even though it may or may not be a term you're familiar with, to look at decolonization and how that is an important piece of Arctic policy. Also, when I look at resource development, I think it's important as you set policy that resource development has to contribute back to the indigenous communities that are affected. And British Columbia and Canada, I think, has a good example. They fund their First Nations with a portion of their mining taxes collected within that province in Canada, and that money goes directly back to those tribes or to those First Nations. So I think as policy, we could look at the state mining tax and how that mining tax can be amended so that affected tribal communities are ensured that they're having a direct impact from that development back to their community. And that could also go with the oil and gas tax, and also state agencies like ADA. And a good example is the Red Dog Road in the Northwest Arctic Borough. It generates a significant amount of revenue to ADA, yet very little of that revenue stays within the region and particularly to the tribes. And so there really needs to be a mechanism, a policy mechanism, to recognize that resource development follows that colonization model of taking resources and putting them up to the global economy or to global corporations. But there has to be a way for the indigenous people to ensure that they're just not in a token beneficial situation, but are having significant economic financial benefits from developments that happen right in their homeland. Some of the other policy recommendations I wanted to mention was community development or community representation on state boards and commissions when it deals with the Arctic. It was interesting looking at the composition of this Arctic commission. Most of the commissioners are not from the high north or from I forget what they call it in Norway. I think it's the high north. And so, you know, it becomes a constant push and pull between north and south representation. You know, and the further north you go in the Arctic, the more you have, I think, true representation of stakeholders. And so I think it's important to look at that policy that you develop for your composition and to make sure that it's not a represented minority, that it's hopefully a representative majority of Arctic residents and stakeholders. And an example of that is, I bring it back to Red Dog Mine. The state of Alaska is establishing a trust fund or something like a trust fund for the perpetual water treatment of the tailings pond, which is part of their the mine permitting process. The water itself needs perpetual treatment, or at least that's what's identified as now. But the trustees of that fund, you know, have yet to be determined, and it's important to look at how local representation as a policy is going to be on that trust fund, so it's just not made up of a series of state workers, but people that have a real genuine interest inside of the safe water treatment and discharge of that tailings pond in perpetuity. The other policy recommendation I wanted to hit on was on research. I think as a policy, I think it'd be important to establish a priority where the principal investigator or the co-principal investigator is based in the Arctic, where they live in the community. That type of research is much different than when you have research done by universities and so forth that might be in Texas or Florida or Anchorage or Fairbanks. It's much different when you have a principal investigator or a co-PI based in the Arctic that live in one of our communities. And I want to mention that because as you understand the Arctic and papers are published, that's going to be an important piece of understanding and making sure their communities are represented and involved in that process. And the best way to do that is to have the research done as close as possible versus as removed. The last thing I want to mention is on port development in the Arctic. I think as a policy, it's important to realize that just one port is not going to be sufficient to serve in the future. Kotzebue has been working on the development of Cape Blossom, which I'm sure you've heard of through Reggie and through Kolok. But it's important, I think, to look at a policy where multiple ports are necessary for safe marine transportation through the Arctic. So it's just not putting money into a single port, but a policy that looks at multiple ports. And a good example is Norway. I happened to be there in their Arctic. I was very impressed by their Arctic infrastructure and multiple ports that they had serving vessels, both community vessels and global transportation vessels. So with those comments, I'd like to say take Gula back to the commission for this listening session and a chance to share some of our thoughts that we have from our community.
You have questions from the commission?
Thank you, Tom. This is Reggie. I think you hit on some real key points. And, thank you for that.
Okay. So this is Nils, Andreas, and Tom. Thanks very much for your comments. I think that you bring up a lot of issues and areas that we spend a lot of time talking about and a lot of things that we've heard actually over the course of the year. Especially, I think what I sensed in a lot of your comments is the increased need for meaningful participation and inclusion at the table in decision-making processes. And I think that, you know, I sense that the report and some of the policy statements really reflect that in a lot of ways. There's been a lot of encouragement of bringing more people to the table for to have more robust conversations. And I've actually been really, it's been great to see that occur throughout the course of the commission's lifetime. I think a number of the issues that you bring up end up being statewide issues that have been difficult to parse out from Arctic. The commission's really operated under a definition of the Arctic that was developed by as part of the Arctic Research and Policy Act that the U.S. government So it's really a federal definition that we've been operating under. But in general, it's hard to parse out Arctic from Alaska. And the issues that you brought up are important to Alaskans, to the state, and to Arctic residents. And that's something that I think Commission is committed to continually wrestling with and hopefully producing some good outcomes toward. But I also recognize that it's we're sensitive to the complexity. I would love to have a follow-up conversation with you about decolonization. I think that would be an interesting conversation. Maybe just one final, maybe this is actually a question for you because the rest has just been commenting. This is something that I've been wrestling with at the Institute of the North as representing international Arctic organizations, really faced often with this question of local, subnational, national, international decision-making and how those relate back to one another. And the thing that I struggle with is, does location determine capability? And how do we balance and work toward really fully integrating the perspectives of local communities and peoples into fairly distant and complicated decision-making practices that serve, a national and really a global interest? So that's maybe another follow-up conversation that we can have. But I think these are things that certainly the Commission is and has been wrestling with, but I'm really glad that you've brought them up.
I think that is a challenge. I mean, the interest in the Arctic is in resource development is in the trillions, just in Alaska alone. I think we have to recognize that financial stake. It's not in the billions, it's in the trillions. And with that, I think there's the resources. I know there's the resources to properly engage communities at the right level. And we're operating in 2014, not in 1914. And we have to also recognize that. And I think it's important to look at those policies and, say, this is our policy. We want to see this implemented, And those are the comments I'm bringing forward. I see what you're saying with the meaningful community engagement, and I saw that in the report and talked a bit about Kolak about that. So I think there's a way we can still work on that, and I think your commission is exactly the body to hold the industry, governments, agencies, to this standard.
Thanks.
Thank you, Nils. Representative Herron.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. And Tom, I really appreciate your comments, and to say the least, you articulated it very well of all the concerns of people of both Western and Northern Alaska and how we need to educate the rest of Alaskans, because you can't separate Alaska from the Arctic. But you clearly stated the struggle. But, what's interesting is that shortly, here in the third week, Jimmy and ICC are going to host a meeting in Nunavik, and there's going to be a lot of people from southern part of the world. They're going to come up there. In Whistler, B.C., there's going to be PENWAR and the Arctic Caucus meeting, and there's going to be many people from Canada and the United States there, and we're going to be talking about the Arctic. Then in Iqaluit, on the other side of the Hudson Bay, is Canada's going to host a Arctic Economic Council, the first meeting, and then the parliamentarians, Arctic parliamentarians, are going to meet in Whitehorse in mid-September. Then Institute of the North is going to have their meeting in mid-October Nome and Kotz, and so these meetings go on and on, and so it's really great opportunities. And of course, there in mid-August, St. Lawrence is going to, the Bering Sea Alliance is going to host their meetings there as well, and inviting a lot of people. And then last but not least is the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission is coming to your community in Nome at the end of August. And so all these conversations are about trying to address the concerns that you've relayed. And I really do appreciate you, in your way, highlighting this issue of how do we address the people, especially on in coastal Alaska and the Bering Sea and the Chukchi and the Beaufort, and of course our Canadian counterparts and even our Russian counterparts, how do we deal with this? So again, thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you very much, Tom. I really appreciate your comments also. And you know, it's a completely different way of doing things here in our part of the Arctic than it is in our neighbors to the west and our neighbors to the east. One nation is nationalizing the Arctic, and not including the indigenous people in their policies and all the other stuff that they have. And I'm talking about the Russians. And then we have the Canadians who are working with the indigenous tribes, with the First Nations in Canada, in terms of preparing for the what's inevitable, is that they have declared a transportation corridor on the western side of their border, along there, all the way up to the north, including rail, roads, and ships. And during the session, a couple of Canadians came from tribes in British Columbia, and they're doing those things now, working with the Indigenous people, with First Nations in Canada. And it's a completely different here, and in the U.S. we're trying to get together with the national, with the federal government and the state, and we all have we seem to be planting flags everywhere, different organizations or different the governments, Alaska and the federal and the local people. And this is my area and all that. We should be doing what the Canadians and are doing, working together. And my cousin over there behind there is one of the people who was instrumental in starting that relationship between the high Arctic. And he's still working on it. So I think we need to. And I like the idea of multiple ports, and because there's different types of conditions in the various portions of the Arctic. And thank you again, Tom, for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you, Ben.
Mayor Jewell.
Thank you. Tom, you did something very artfully, and that is to bring up some real challenges that are omitted specifically in the report, but you presented those in a way that shows the opportunity within those challenges. And that was very artfully done. And for that, it's greatly appreciated, because, you know, if you look at the history of the Arctic, I guess, and the people of the Arctic, the indigenous people, at different junctures, the challenge has been, whether it's at the political level or even at the economic level, how do we deal with those people? In some regards, that conversation is the same, and it's changing. And it's changing in part because we've grown into an economic force in this state. But there's still some challenges that we need to overcome, and if we look through the eyes of the opportunity lens, I think it makes those challenges a little bit more. What's the word I'm looking for? You begin to see the richness of the diversity of the people we have, and your point of benefiting from the economic development yet to come in places that have the highest cost of living, the most challenges, whether it's in energy or anything else, transportation issues, points well made. For that, greatly appreciated.
Nils, do you have another question?
Maybe. And really, these the work sessions that we've had since the release of the preliminary report have been very interactive and mm-hmm. dialogic. So hopefully we keep that pattern. Tom, one thing you mentioned was that that really when we're talking about investment opportunities in the Arctic, we're talking in the trillions. You know, we just got back from our Finland policy tour, and in northern Finland, they're talking about 154 billion euros in investment opportunities. So I can imagine that your number is pretty close. I don't. This is breaking protocol, but Jack, one thing that strikes me in thinking about your presentation and really maybe building off of Tom's is really is there a difference between that we should recognize better in our report in terms of maritime activity and food security related to marine mammals and maritime? Really, that's the increasing activity that is driving some of this conversation. Do we see similar challenges on the land side of things, and in what ways, and have we recognized those? So I guess my question is really, when we're talking about food security, are we talking about different kinds of food securities in maritime and land? I'm a terrible question asker. These are just me thinking for those of you on the phone, and everybody can see in the room that's a... I'm done.
And I know we're set up as a listening session, but as Nils said, we've tried to strive to make these more of a dialogue because the Commission has expressed a lot of questions to different entities. So if there's a answer that you want to bring back up, you're always welcome to, Jack, or anyone else on the line. So thank you. Koinapak Ukalesak, I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts from the Native Village of Kotzebue's perspective and the things that you highlighted. I know the Native Village of Kotzebue is very involved in research locally and other activities. So thank you again, Koinapak, for calling in. I think next on our list we have Art Ivanov with BSA. Art, are you still on the line?
Good morning. My name is Art Ivanov, and I am the CEO for the Barents Sea Alliance, LLC, which is composed of Wales, Gamble, St. Michael, Stebbins, Unalakleet, Gullivan, Sitnasauk, which is Nome. I just wanted to touch on a couple things. One is we endorse development just based on the sheer size, the volume of hydrocarbons that are found in the Arctic, but we also want to address food security. And one method we felt is critical of protecting our food resources is by building depots in several strategic locations. And we have several villages that are in a good location to address an incident if it were to occur. We have Wales and we have Gamble that are very much interested in the dialogue. With that in mind, Representative Heron did mention the Arctic Resource Development and Infrastructure meeting in Gamble. That session will be held on August 12th and 13th. And we've got a host of federal state agencies to come and discuss the issue in more detail. And really, we're trying to figure out how to make it count for villages that have been left, for the most part, at the sidelines. And again, I think it's really important for villages that are out there in the Arctic to be involved in the dialogue, to have a place at the table. And it seems like for the most part, we're always brushed aside, and agencies are making decisions for us, and we think it's wrong. We definitely think there's a need for inclusion. We think we've matured over the years to make decisions that are national and international. Again, a warm invitation for the meeting for the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission members. We definitely would like a presentation made by this body to give villages that will be attending an opportunity to hear what the thought is as relates to your recommendations. We think it's a great opportunity for you and for us. I think Jake mentioned, and I'd like to echo, the need for smaller satellite ports. No port clearance is going to take a significant amount of resources to build, but we also think gamble whales could play a potential role. And I want to stress the need for building the depots in several villages. We've had a dialogue with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, ARO, regarding depots, and we're trying to figure out how we might be able to work across the board together to achieve that, to ensure that when it comes to food security, we have the equipment on the ground and we have trained personnel, which brings me to some training sessions that were just wrapped up. BSA, ARS just wrapped up a training session in Unalakleet, which was funded by Shell Oil. We have 50 trained personnel available for rapid deployment, and I think this is one step in building that capacity. Training is essential, and I think it's really important that the state put the resources into training so that our people can secure those positions, those high-paying positions that are going to come with development in the Arctic. Again, thank you again for this opportunity, and if there's any questions, I'll take them.
Commissioners, have any questions for Mr. Ivanov? Thank you, Mr. Ivanov, for calling in. We always appreciate hearing from you and raising those concerns. I know for communities in the Northwest, and some of the work that we've done at NANA, there's been a lot of discussion about ensuring that local individuals can assist in oil spill response and receive the training necessary to do that. And I remember hearing about the training program that you all put together and definitely appreciate that kind of proactive approach to it. So it was really great to hear about that. So thank you for calling in again, and hope you stick around for more of the discussion.
Thank you.
Anyone else joined us online or signed up for testimony in the back?
I have a question for Art.
Okay.
All right. Art, this is Nils Andreasen. To what extent is the port or ports question market driven?
Well, there was a report that was just released by Northern Economics, and it sounds like for the most part it is the ports are driven. I mean, it just can't be accomplished without oil and gas development in the Arctic. And I think there was a report also by the GAO that suggested that the infrastructure isn't feasible unless we have some sort of development. And again, BSA is suggesting that we'd like to endorse that process, but I think what's really important, though, is building that infrastructure where we could have vessels that are available and trained personnel. For the BSA, I think that's a really that's a big step in securing the resources that we depend on. And I think there's an obligation on part of the federal government as well as the state and industry in ensuring that the people that live on the coast could carry on their subsistence way of life for generations to come.
Yeah. If there, so based on those two reports, is it fair to say that if there is no offshore oil and gas development, there is a decreased need for port infrastructure?
I think we just heard that there's what we have in the Arctic is worth trillions, and I think development will occur. It's just a matter of time. And it's, as Admiral Ossebo once said, it's not a matter of if, but when a disaster occurs. And instead of leaving things to chance, BSA is really opting to build that capacity.
Really a chicken or the egg kind of thing. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, this is David Guttenberg. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Loud and clear.
Thank you. So the role I have on this commission is has been sharing the defense and the security aspect of it, and that's been mostly dealing with industry and the military. And the military, through the Coast Guard and all of its Arctic response that they're building up, is going to be one of the drivers on this, whether we like it or not. I mean, if something happens, then they're going to be driving the train about where infrastructure is, and they're very aware of the lack of infrastructure. Actually, it's very concerning for them. I mean, we're also expecting a announcement on a icebreaker, but there's a lot of things that they talk to us about that they're doing in planning. I mean, because this is a national defense issue, and there's going to be a lot of money flowing this way through whatever channels it is. I mean, it's not just one military entity; it's across the boards, and whether it's whatever port they decide to do on, there's going to have to be comparable alternative. But in the end, there's not a lot of things in the commission that we're going to be actually say to tell them what to do. But I think setting up the infrastructure, which I think is one of the main things that the commission is designed to do, is have something in place that's the real Arctic. But that military component is going to be driving a lot of the train when economic development hits, whether it's oil and gas or shipping or tourism through the Bering. So that's something not to forget, that as the Coast Guard and the military, and that includes the defense component and the rescue and the oil spill and all those things that are kind of outside of what we're doing. But all the things that we have been talking about is setting up the preferred infrastructure and the way we want things done. But when we talk about where we want things done, and whether it's shipping or whatever, the Coast Guard and its needs, and the Navy, and are going to have a big say in what they want to do. We just have to put our things and our concerns and our preferences in place. And certainly a big part of that is having an infrastructure, and the money that follows behind that through defense and security will be considerable. So I just wanted to put that into the mix about what is out there that we don't see. I mean, we can talk about whales, we can talk about shipping, talk about salmon, but the defense and security is like big ships over the horizon. When they start moving, it'll be a monster heading our way. And having things in place where our preferences exist, they'll actually be wanting to know what those are. So we can't forget that. Thank you.
If I can, I'd like to add that the Department of Defense will be out in Gambell to discuss the Arctic policy, but they have also indicated they'd like to speak about climate change. But you look at what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, it just seems like things are heated up again, and that there's a real need to pony up the resources for dealing with the situation that we now face. And again, BSA is open for business. We've got St. Michael, which is south of us that has secured or set aside 1,000 acres for building some sort of infrastructure, an industrial park. We're reaching out to the Department of Defense as well, just trying to figure out how to make it count for villages so that we receive some of the benefits with development.
Thank you. Jack, did you want to come up and say something? I think for the folks on the phone, please, yeah, on the microphone.
This is Jack on me again. I was just wanting to respond to Mr. Andreessen's question earlier, or maybe statement about port development. Hazard response being driven by economics. I want to reiterate Mr. Ivanov said it's unfortunate, although I'm a realist, it's unfortunate that you know, much of what we do is always sort of weighted or considered against economic benefits. It's unfortunate that port development is you know, being viewed as against immediate returns on an investment. Port development, the reason why I wanted to come up is I can't speak for the Northwest Arctic Borough or the North Slope Borough, but I know a few things about the Port Clarence development, the recently decommissioned Loran site. I believe at Bering Straits, the regional corporation is in the process of having that land conveyed to them, and they just put forth their own internal assessment of the economic feasibility of Port Clarence as a deep water response port. So if you're not, if you haven't had the opportunity to read that yet, it was recently published. But one thing to keep in mind is, you know, the development of these response capabilities, wherever they be, we have to look at them a little differently. We're not talking about immediate, perhaps visible or immediate returns. What we're talking about is allowing the people that we represent, at least for the Marine Mammal Coalition, and rural Alaska, is to for the continuation of these people to continue their economic sustainability and lifeways. Now, subsistence use, harvesting marine mammals, doesn't always line up nicely and neatly with our understandings of economic models and benefits. But with the ability to have response time cut down by the development of these ports, what we're talking about is ensuring the economic sustainability for the rural villages that most of us here represent. So, in short, you know, it may not look nice in a bank ledger when we're talking about devoting resources to the development of these ports, but quite frankly, if there's a spill or any sort of hazard or disaster like that, we're talking about a massive economic blow to the rural Alaskan communities that we represent by not being able to harvest the subsistence resources.
Thank you. Are there any other folks on the line who've joined us that want to provide testimony or anyone in the room? Jimmy?
My name is, for the record, Jim Stotts. I'm from Barrow. I'm the president of ICC Alaska. And I'm here primarily because I've almost felt hounded that I should come here and say something. So I'm here. I have a couple of comments. I wanted to hang back to hear what's being said from the communities. It's always nice to know what's on people's minds up north. And then I wanted to give you an opportunity to ask me any and all questions you might have. I know there's a question about food security. I'll try to answer that. And and any other questions you might have. Thanks for giving us a plug for our General Assembly in Inuvik at the end of this month. It'll be a good time. I know a number of you will be there. At least these two guys will be there. Are you going?
Yes.
And some in the back, too, I think, are going. So we'll all get together there and have a good time and talk with our ILAs from across the countries. I think what's important for this policy that you are developing is to look at it from a different angle than people have been traditionally looking at these sorts of things. I know it's the state's policy, and there's a federal policy, and there's an Arctic Council and all of these things, but for whatever reason, it seems that when, in my opinion, the state's policy is a very localized, selfish policy. It's looking at what's best for the state of Alaska, with a slight nod to the federal government, a little bit of a nod to the Arctic Council. But what's at stake here is a region of the world, the Arctic region. And so I think what's important is that that the state of Alaska approach this from, like, we're part of a group, a bigger group, and where do we fit, and let's work together. And that's a very general statement, but I think it's important that this group does that rather than setting itself up to argue for its peace or argue about, boo-hoo federal government, you're doing this, or, that sort of approach, or this region wants support and that region wants support, and maybe the best place to put a port's in neither place, but, that conversation should be had. Actually, when it comes to ports in the Arctic Ocean, I think all eight countries ought to get together and figure out where the best place to put them is. And it doesn't really matter which country. But set up a port that'll service this industry, that fishing fleet, the best place for search and rescue, the best place for oil spill cleanup, and rather than having eight different, or more than eight, I mean, if you look at Russia, they'll probably have five or six, in each country. But figure out some way to coordinate that. I know that takes a little time, which brings me to the second point I'd like to make about what's going on here. There is a rush going on. It's just like everybody thinks, like, God, if we don't do it by yesterday, we will have missed our chance, or the Russians will be ahead of us, or whatever reason we have. What's the rush here? Let's take our time and do it right. And I'm not saying slow it down to a crawl, but, I mean, it just seems like bang, 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 we got to do this, you're behind, blah, 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 blah. And next thing you know, we're making decisions that are, I'll just call them half-assed decisions. That's what I think of them. So those are a couple of things that I think are missing in the spirit of this policy that you're working on. When it was the Northern Waters Task Force, which morphed into this commission, I gave a couple of testimonies, and I would like to say thank you to Reggie Jewell for being a real, more or less the creator of that, and for your work, too. At that time, there was a battle going on down in Juneau over people like me affectionately like to remember as the Coastal Zone Management Plan program, which was the only opportunity for local communities to get in their licks and their ideas on development in the coastal zone. That's gone now. Anytime somebody mentions it, that'll never come back. But without some sort of mechanism or process which puts the local communities, the Arctic, I'll call that the Arctic, that's the real Arctic up there, those communities, into the equation where they can really wheel and deal with the state and the feds as they used to back in the past. There's very little trust that the Arctic communities will have for any of this stuff. It's a matter of politics, and it's a matter of control. I'll just say it that bluntly. If the local people don't have a piece of action, a skin in the game, a right to make decisions alongside the others, as far as we're concerned, as far as I'm concerned, it's a wasted effort. Colonialization still is going on. And the idea of decolonization that Tom brought up, I think it's a valid point. How to approach it, I don't know, but it is a valid point. It's important that there be a mechanism and a process that the local people are part of the solution. Without that, you know, people up in Barrow are just saying, oh, those people down in Juneau, just like the people in Juneau say, those people down in D.C., It's just a one domino effect after the other. So let's be blunt about it. You need to have something in your policy that addresses this. There are a number of issues concerning healthy communities. I don't know how else to say it, but the healthy communities that this commission should look at, and they're. There are issues from all kinds of things like adaptations for climate change impacts. Some of the towns are falling into the ocean or falling into riverbanks because of climate change, primarily. There needs to be something addressed about that. There's rampant suicide problems in northern communities. Somebody has to take a look at that. There are infrastructure issues with quality of housing, quality of water and sewer, quality of dumps, that sorts of stuff. Those things need to look at. There's a bunch of things that I would just say you could probably bundle up into something called sustainable communities. I think you need something like that in there. And when you bring that in, then you're hit right in the face immediately with the word called culture. And that culture must be protected. It must be looked at. Everything that you want to talk to somebody in Barrow about or Kotzebue or Wainwright has to, you have to do your best to crouch it in the perspective of their culture there. Quite frankly, some things in the outside culture doesn't mean nothing to us up there. It just doesn't mean nothing to us. It's different. And it's not right. It's not wrong. But that's the way it is. There has to be a respect for our culture. If you want us to respect yours, you have to respect ours. On the issue of food security, people have a hard time and struggle with this notion, particularly if you're not from our culture. Food security is culture. Food security is economics. It's our way. It's our life. Mm-hmm. Our whole way of living is changing. It's changing, no doubt about that. But it was driven by the seasons, by the hunting seasons. There's a time for going for the birds. There's a time to pick the berries. There's we all know that. If those of us that have grown up in the little villages up north, it's been an issue in this state for 50 years, the whole issue of fish and game and how do we handle fish and game. We've all almost had riots at times in our history over this issue. People have gone to jail for this. Just as recently as last summer, people are being thrown in jail for doing what they've done for as long as they can remember. I always like to say that if you want to go hunting anymore, you almost have to be a lawyer because the myriad of regulation and laws and different acts that apply to you as you're out there hunting on the land or in the water, I mean, it's like it's like crazy. If you cross a river, there's one set of rules. Cross back, it's another set of rules. You got a district. Yeah, it's just a mess for the end users. There has to be somewhere, I think, in this policy, a statement to support the indigenous peoples of this state in their right to access and be part of the management of those resources. It can't be given, in the case of on the land, to the state, in the case of the water, to the feds. It has to be a true co-management approach, or this problem will just continue. It's not going away. People aren't going to stop hunting. People will go to jail before they stop hunting. That's been proven in the past. I don't see anything that's going to change that. I can remember when they tried to stop whaling in Barrow. I was at a public meeting where Jimmy Carter declared there will be no more whaling. And so they had this meeting up in Barrow. You know, I would not have wanted to be in a federal game warden up there at that time. People were ready to shoot them. I'm serious. They interviewed a guy from Point Hope, Billy Weber. You know Billy Weber. It was published in the Los Angeles Times. It said, you know, Jimmy Carter has done this and he's doing that, and it's for the, you know, the safety of the whales and all those poor whales and blah, blah, blah. And Billy Weber said, well, Jimmy Carter can kiss my ass. And that's what people think about this. So something has to be done about the food security, because Inuit, Inupiat, Yupik, the different Indian tribes, the Aleuts, we view the world through our connection to those animals and the nature. That's, I don't know how else to say it. It's as simple as that. It's as important as going to churches for you guys. That important. Imagine somebody telling you can't go to church anymore. That's the way I would characterize this. You can't go to church. Well, what would happen? World War III, IV, V, and VI. That's what would happen. And that's how important this is to us. I can't say it any more bluntly than that. And then I'll give you a chance to ask me any question you have. Benny.
First of all, I want to thank you for all your commitment to our part of the world since we were kids. I grew up with Jimmy. I've known him most of my life. He happens to be family. Jimmy started in the organizations when they first came out. He's a business major. He's got a degree in business, and he was helpful in creating the ESOC and also the North Shore Borough. And thank you for your words on coastal zone management. I know you had some input into that from the very beginning, and it worked from our part of the world with the industry when, you know, when there was something, case in point, the Endicott project, they built that the causeway in Prudhoe Bay, and several years later they had problems in Nooksack. The population of the Cisco, the Arctic Cisco that they depend on, went down. And so working with, I think you were probably in assembly about that time, and I'm working with the industry, and they did a study, and then come to find out the areas where they were traveling through were cut off. But then they had a solution to make breaches. A few breaches along that causeway, and it worked. That was in working together with the North Shore Borough and the state of Alaska and the industry. So that worked. I don't know why it is no longer the case that we have an Arctic zone management. So I just want to thank you again for the commitment you have made and being one of the founding members of the ICC. Thank you very much for your commitment. Continue to do that. Thank you.
So, Liz, Jimmy, I appreciate your testimony today, and I think what it shows is that there are gaps. There are gaps in the past, and there are probably gaps in the future that the Policy Commission should address this. But facetiously, I wish you wouldn't have been so restrained in your comments. And
did my best.
Yeah. But the thing about it is that this is I've never shared this with anyone before, but after the creation of the commission, after Northern Wireless Task Force, in 2012, I stopped by Jimmy's office, and I wanted to talk to him, and he says, I don't want to be a part of your commission. I said, Jimmy, I didn't come here to ask you to be part of the commission. I asked you to be our conscience and our guardian angel, and he's done that. And so I just wanted to is to relay that fact that his testimony today has, as Tom and Art and others, is this air of disappointment, but a challenge at the same time for the commission. For us to remember what the Bering, the Chukchi, and the Beaufort mean to a lot of people in Alaska. And the thing about food security, it was only yesterday, headline news and Anchorage Daily News and the Alaska Dispatch, is the Kuskokwim fish issue. Now, it's the same thing. It's security. People were scared. Very scared. Unfortunately, the Chums and the Reds were okay, but the Kings are in a disaster. So that's just a minor point in the overarching issue of food security that faces a lot of people in Alaska. And so again, I think that the testimony today that Liz and Reggie have called for this listening session. It's very important, and we don't, we've had a lot of teleconferences of these teams and the work they're doing, and it's all been very important. So, again, I think that the testimony today, by all, is that again we have gaps that we need to address. And then one final comment, just so because Coastal Zone is near and dear to a lot of people, is that the leadership of this state walked away with the basketball and left us at the table when we were this close to getting some sort of semblance of a Coastal Zone management. I was bitterly disappointed, and I was in a press conference with Edward, Ida, Reggie, myself, Donnie, and Bryce Edgman, where we clearly demonstrated that the constituents that we represented unfortunately were left at the altar, and we need to get back. And Jimmy, I just want to say thank you for challenging the commission that there needs to be a Coastal Zone management program and that the commission should recommend that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heron. I also wanted to recognize our other co-chair, Senator McGuire. Thank you for joining us. It's great to see you here. Do you have any questions for Jim Stotts?
No, I want to say thank you to Jimmy. And I think, as we've traveled the state over the last, I guess it's been year and a half now, your comments have been echoed by elders and others in communities that we've been in, the issue of food security. And I liked your analogy to religion because it strikes, that chord. I think about communistic countries and places I've been in my life, Cuba and Russia and other places where a governmental regime will come in and try to come between people and their gods, as an example. And what you find is that people will find a way to to their God, and usually it's underground. And what you'll find is that once that oppressive regime lifts up, that you'll find all these churches in ways that people have found their ways. And similarly, the animals, the whales, the seals, that's your God. It's the way that your culture and your people for thousands of years have been communing with your spirits and your culture and your spirit animals. And I've seen that through my years in Alaska. So I'm very supportive and recognize that the Arctic is about the people, their food security, the culture and the spirit that comes through that process. The Nalakatuk that I was just at a couple of days ago was another example of that, that it isn't just the food itself, but it's the offering of the food and the way that the whaling captains distribute that food and how that means to be, a way to provide for all of the people in a community sense. It's not just your own family, but it's to everyone and a way of surviving. And I guess the challenge that we have and the tension that we've had in our group of 26 commissioners is that as we look to the future and the opportunities that the Arctic brings, we want to sustain and have resilience for the thousands of years of culture that have been there, the food security and the culture and the people, and then we want to welcome the opportunities that are coming that we can't do anything about. I mean, the receding ice has brought this new pathway, this opening of the Northwest Passage, and with it is going to come this opportunity to ship goods, to ship people, to shorten pathways, has come the opening for drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi and the potential to fill up our Trans-Alaska pipeline, to bring new jobs, to bring new revenue to a state that has relied 90% of its revenue for our schools and our roads and our ports. And all those things are good. And how do we balance that in a way that makes us survivors and resilient and beautiful, strong people? And I would just say that those are my comments, that however we balance our policy, we're trying to reach that goal. And it's a tough one. And the issue of coastal zone management has been one of those issues. That has been the fight that's come right down to the end and to the point that my dear friend and co-chair brings up, which is that people fought right up to the end. One side wanted its way entirely and having veto power, and those who were more, I would say, oil and gas resource development-minded said, if you have veto power, then that might threaten our ability to have these oil and gas resources developed for the future. And they were scared. And on the other side, the people that wanted the veto right said, well, but what about our ability to have food security? And so you've got a lot of fear and you've got butting heads. And I see both values. So as we move into the future, this precious, beautiful land that we have of the Arctic is representative of the whole state and all of the people. And I hope we can balance it.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Mayor Jewell, do you have questions?
Thank you, Jimmy. There's been, ICC, the Inuit Circumpolar Council, has an avenue to the Arctic Council as a permanent member, and Alaska, and I'm not sure I'm using the right terminology here, along with several other, while they might not be member nations, they're certainly indigenous seats at the table globally. And the United States is a member of the Arctic Council because of Alaska, and in particular because there is an Arctic component to the state of Alaska. And my question is this. There are I think, two, possibly three avenues that the state of Alaska could probably benefit by building relationship either with the indigenous groups that have a status at the Arctic Council or the federal government. Is our state doing that?
Well, that's a good question.
I know.
I went to high school with his sister. So. So, you know, the Arctic actually is a pretty small place in terms of people, and actually we have cousins over in Russia, and we have cousins in Canada, and I'm married to a gal from Greenland, and so it's a pretty small group. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago at the Department of State hosted an oceans conference there, and ran into a bunch of people I run into all over the place, primarily through the Arctic Council effort that ICC is involved in. There I ran into Stephanie Moreland, who I've known her since she worked for Murkowski, Senator Murkowski. And, you know, I've tried, and actually, you know, I think we get along. We don't always agree on the different positions, and she is very loyal to, you know, her bosses, and sometimes I'm at odds with what they think, and I'd like to think I'm tainting her and winning her, but I'm not sure. Maybe. But she's, you know, she's a good advocate. So the state does actually attend some Arctic Council functions. One of my grand nieces, Kate Wolgamuth, goes regularly with Kip Lutzen and others. Drew Pierce has attended some meetings of when they were developing the what's called the Arctic Economic Council and so forth. So the state, I think, is welcome to be part of the U.S. Delegation, and in recent years, you see people from the state more than previous. Previously, didn't see the state much, except for Meade Treadwell. When he became, before he was became lieutenant governor, he was, you know, ran the research commission, and he was a regular, as Fran Ulmer is now. So I think that's the one part of your question. I think the state is trying to work with the feds, and I think the feds have, you know, come on, you know, and have invited, you know, a relationship. I think I'm right. I'll ask you. I think that's true. With the PPEs, permanent participants, there's less of an outreach. I would say ICC has a real good relationship with the U.S. government. Not as well with the state of Alaska. And it comes down to the local issues of, you know, food security and the coastal zone. You know, these issues that I mentioned earlier, they were just at such odds from the points of view there. But we try to, you know, the Arctic Council is a very diplomatic sort of organization, so, you know, you have to be proper and so forth. I see Neil, he's at those meetings quite a bit. We try to talk together. We understand where we differ in opinion, but that doesn't mean we can't talk. We do. So that's sort of an answer, I guess. If the state wanted to, like, buddy up with ICC, they'd have to make some concessions, quite frankly. They'd have to, like, you know, address these issues that I raised earlier.
And
I don't know how else to say it. I mean, you know, we've drawn our line in the sand.
Yeah. You said it, I think, the only way that it could be said, and that's why I asked the question. I've got to quit turning pens and clicking.
Do I need to give you something else to...
You said something very key, and that is the relationship that ICC has with the federal government, the United States government.
ICC Alaska.
ICC Alaska. And I think that is kind of at the core of an overall Arctic policy and some of the discussions in Alaska, and that is... There is that recognition of government-to-government relations, and while that has been attempted in the past, it just seems to have languished, and there's certain, I think, recognitions, but overall that outreach is on a state level makes it difficult to have certain conversations, and... But that is going to be one of the challenges, I think, in part of this policy, but also a real potential opportunity. And like the state of Alaska, in a relationship with the United States government, there are tensions inherent to that relationship. But there are many times that we can forge a path and probably get along more often than they disagree. And I guess the statement that I wanted to make is that the same could happen in forging a relationship with Alaska's Native people and tribes in particular, that, yes, there would be some places that there would be tension. But there would be many places that there could be opportunities for both to work together and build off of that. But thank you for coming over.
If I may make a comment to your comments. ICC Alaska is not a tribal organization.
No, I understand.
And we've been told that by the U.S. government. And then they invite us to the meetings as if we were a tribal organization. Because we have tribal organizations that are our members, the regional corporations, the regional nonprofit associations. And we have state organizations that are our members too, Northwest Arctic Borough, North Slope Borough. So, but, you know, we are an international NGO. Which leads me to, I know that you are the sole representative of a tribal organization on this commission. That's what I understand. And in the early first meetings of the Northern Waters Task Force, one of the points that I made on behalf of ICC was that this commission needs a tribal representative, needs tribal representation. Which leads to another issue, and that's the lack of recognition that the state gives to tribal organizations. There's no Indian land. There's no this. You know, it's kind of a relationship like that, where I think if the state was to engage with tribal organizations, it would be a lot better for everybody. So those tribal organizations do have a function. They do have trust of their people, which is very important.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, unless there are commissioners on the line or Nils, you haven't. Sorry,
I do have comments or questions, but go ahead, please.
Okay, and we'll jump to commissioners on the line in just a second. This is probably more of a specific question. One of the things that I've really struggled with is that we love to use this term, and you know it's this phrase that everybody loves in the sustainable communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that means different things to different people, right? It's a very heuristic term. And I'm wondering from ICC's perspective or even some of the work in the Arctic Council, if there's any definition of sustainable communities that this commission should be thinking about, like how should we be thinking about sustainable communities in the Arctic?
Well, that's a tough one. I don't think there is a definition. I don't have a definition for sustainable communities. I do have a we do have a definition for sustainable development, and it's a little different than the common understanding of what that means, which the common understanding is a balance between resource economic development and the environment, concern for the environment. That's the standard. There must be a sustainability of the environment when this resource development is going on. So it's a balance between resource development and protection of the environment. ICC takes a position that there's a third leg to this, and that is sustainability of our culture. If our culture is not sustainable, you can have all the environment and the economic development, you know, appear to be balanced, but if we're losing our culture in the process, it doesn't work for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I appreciate that. And I think if I can ask a little bit more, too, one of the issues that you hit on that's really important is that there is a major issue with suicide across the circumpolar Arctic, especially in the Inuit community, especially Inuit men. And I guess one of the things that we've talked about in the commission is sometimes when we talk about sustainable communities, we also talk about healthy communities. Is there anything that we should be taking into consideration relative to healthy communities that maybe we haven't quite captured yet?
Well, ICC and the other permanent participants to the Arctic Council, ICC is sort of leading this project, one of the Arctic Council working groups called the Sustainable Development Working Group, and it's looking at suicide, and which has been looked at actually quite a bit from a lot of different directions, but I even have a theory, and I'm not a psychiatrist. I think the problem with the young men is I think they're getting lost in this transition that's going on, this very rapid transition from people always ask me, are you a real Eskimo? And I say, well, no, not really, because, you know, I went to Mount Edgecombe and I can drive a car. But I always like to say that when I was a little boy, I saw the last ones. The elders, when I was a little boy, I'm in my mid-60s now, those were the real Eskimos. Mm-hmm. They never had a job. They didn't speak English. They did. I mean, these were the real McCoy, as we would say. And so in 66 years, gone from that, got the internet now. You know, I mean, yeah, the world has changed. And it's not just for us, but for the whole world. 80 years ago, the alpha male in that village was the best hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Period. That was the umelik, or the captain of the whaling crew. He was the leader, and then there was this spiritual guy called Angatkuk, who was sort of his partner in crime. You know,
mm-hmm.
But that guy was really the leader of that community. Okay, then fast forward, you had the land claims, regional corporations, village progress, civilization. Who's the leader in that community now? Well, it's not that guy anymore. It's the president of the village corp. It's the president of the borough assembly. Those are the people that are the leaders now. Being a hunter is not the status that there used to be, and so these young men are growing up being told they need to be hunters and providers . We haven't made a way for them to keep that pride and status. I mean, if you're a good hunter, I mean, you're probably living on the poverty level. First place, you can't. One thing I really like about Greenland, if you're a good hunter, you can make a good living because you can sell your catch in the open market. And I mean, if you're a good hunter, you can make a good living. We don't have that opportunity here in Alaska. If you try to sell your catch, you're breaking the law, actually. So somewhere, and it's the men. It's the men that are they're being pushed to be hunters, but they really should, pushed to be lawyers and engineers and accountants and school teachers. It's a problem. It's less of a problem for the women, the young gals. I mean, they're. I've noted it. You know, after the land claims, all the leaders of the land claims organizations were all men. They're all women now.
Yep.
Yeah. The mayor of the North Slope Borough, the president of NANA, you know, the president of Bering Straits Native Corporation, the president of CORC. They're all women because they went to school. They're making the transition better than the men are. I don't know how you handle that. I think if we made a way for those men to young men to feel good about themselves, I think that's the problem. They can't feel good about themselves. That's my own personal thought. I'm sure some psychiatrists will tell me I'm wrong, but I do know that there is some truth to that. That the men are having a harder time, clearly, than the women.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for sharing those thoughts. And it's not something, in my own understanding, that is unique to our culture. I mean, Torres Strait Islanders face the same challenges, Aboriginals in Australia, with their men.
I think it's a loss, getting lost in the transition. It's so fast.
Yeah. Representative McGack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were a matriarchal society anyway, that's my opinion. And I am also of the opinion that you should be the next leader of the Arctic Council. Not only were you born in the Arctic, you spoke the language since you were born. I mean, you know, I've spoken to you in Inupiaq since I was 6 years old. And I mean, you know, you know the Kalaallit, the language of the Greenlandic Inuit.
Oh.
You know a little, and I think that they're related to the Inuktitut in northeast Canada. You've been successful in the business side of part of life. You've been successful in the local government part of our life, and who better than you to lead us into the next phase of the Arctic? And that's my opinion. And I wish that you consider putting your name in there, because you have grown up in the Arctic. You speak the language fluently. And you introduced my family through your mom, because she supported our wedding group back when we were growing up, to whole wheat bread. That's your mom. She ordered from Fairbanks, I think, or somewhere. She bought a few cases of whole wheat bread for the wedding crew, and I became a lover of whole wheat bread because of your mom. I'm just saying that, there is no better person to lead us into the next phase of Arctic policy. And being from the Arctic, knows the language, knows the people throughout the circumpolar north, because you were involved as president at the ICC for a while. And I just want to make sure that you at least consider it and talk to people. Thank you.
This is Art Ivanovsky. Would I be able to chime in on the problems that we have with suicide?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yes, this is Art Ivanov. I wanted to chime in on the problems that we have with suicide. I know back in the 80s we had this ADN report, People in Peril. And I think there's a lot of youth that were caught, you know, between the ages of 18 and 24 that were caught in this, you know, where do I belong kind of idea, concept. And I think, just having the privilege of traveling to a dozen villages in the last 2 years and looking at the rate of unemployment, I think for me that's an indicator. I think one of the issues that we have to grapple with is the fact that when it comes to the villages, there are no employment opportunities. During our recruitment of the 50 people that we have now on our watch,
we had a lot of youth in the age group that were looking for jobs. And I think perhaps this is one of the solutions to the problematic issues that we face with suicide. I think we had that transition from a subsistence economy to the cash economy, and that was back in the day. But I think today, I think it's just like, you know, where do we belong? You know, we're sort of struggling with hunting, fishing, gathering society, and then these other values that keep bombarding us. I mean, this other culture with technology, and I think one solution is creating some employment opportunities where there aren't any.
Thank you, Art. Did you have something else you want to add to me before I go to Neil?
Well, I was just going to say thank you to Benny for those kind words, but you know, I don't know if I could pass the background check. So.
Neither could I. I just want to say, say something about suicide. And I think it's an important issue, you know, and suicide has no, doesn't acknowledge your status in life, doesn't acknowledge who, what you do, what your family does and all that stuff. It happens to everybody. It happened to me. It happened to my niece a couple weeks ago, my neighbor across the street, and she's in charge of a big organization. And suicide does not know your status in life. Suicide happens. Suicide happened in my family. Suicide. My son killed himself, and my neighbor's son killed himself a couple weeks ago. And it doesn't know your status in life. It just happens. We need to talk to our young people that there is hope. There is life ahead of them. They have problems. Problems happen all the time. We just need to teach our young people, our young men especially, that it takes time to reach that level where you can become someone productive and someone who who can do things to change our lives. It hurts. It hurts to. It really hurts. And I always tell people when I go visit them after they've had someone in their family kill themselves, I told them, it's not gonna be easy. You have a hard road ahead of you. You're gonna cry, 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 cry. It's going to hurt every single day. 5 years it's happened to me. There's not a moment in my life that I don't think of my son. It's not going to go away. But my experience can help people who are contemplating suicide. My experience and other people's experience can help our young people. So when it comes to suicide, talk to them. If you see people, if you just, especially people, young people who look like they've got the weight of the world on their shoulder, be rude. Talk to them. Because, you know, that person may be the person you're helping. Because I don't want anybody else. Unfortunately, it happens all the time. It just happened 2 weeks ago again. So when it comes to suicide, we need to talk about it. We can't shove it under the table anymore. We can't. It should not be taboo. We should be talking about it to our young people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nagak. I guess my hope in asking some of the questions is that I think when we talk about resource development opportunities, economic opportunities, like Mr. Ivanov pointed out, is that things aren't so easily separated when we talk about individuals and communities. It's, I think, easy working on something like this commission's report to get so deep into one particular subject and not think about the things that we can do in each of those areas to help look at how we can support sustainable communities or the sustainable development that you talked about. But I know Mills has been patiently waiting to ask questions. So, Commissioner.
Thank you. I think my comments are going to be somewhat incongruent with the previous comments. It's hard to follow both Benny and Jimmy. I'm really encouraged by the scope of this listening session, and the issues that have been brought up, I think, are not inconsistent with much of what we've heard and worked on over the last year and a half. Actually, a lot of the issues that I think we've talked about today are really the why of what we're doing, even though they've been framed as the what we're doing. There's a real concern and need and challenge that we face in all Alaska communities and in Alaska's Arctic. I think the challenge that the commission has as Alaska's Arctic Policy Commission is twofold, and I think it's our duty to manage expectations relevant to that challenge. One is that the state of Alaska, or that this commission's report, its deliverable is to the state of Alaska legislature. And so really when the recommendations and the issues that we're talking about really need to be related to the jurisdiction and authority that we have. At the same time that there's a geographical scope that we've limited ourselves to. So it's been really, I mentioned this earlier, hard to parse out Alaskan issues. We lead the nation in a number of terrible things, and we're last in the nation in a number of other terrible things as a state. And together as a state, we have a lot of work to do to address them. In the Arctic, I think the things that we are responding to are increased activity and change that will negatively impact or positively impact our people and communities. And the things that we are choosing to focus on relative to the Arctic and within the state's capabilities will impact things like cultures and sustainability of communities and health and education. Those are the why we're doing it. The things that the commission is focused on, I think the things that you see in the report are the what we're doing to hopefully get there. So I would just bring that up because I think it's there in the discussion about whether we should have an Arctic ambassador or not. The State Department for months, if not years, pushed back against that. Why do you need an Arctic ambassador? All the functions of an Arctic ambassador actually are established within current staffing. That why question really strikes me, and it's really for us, it's what are we trying to achieve through this process? Coastal zone management question, and there's a whole lot of us's and them's and we's thrown around in that conversation that confused me. But coastal zone management, the things that are behind coastal zone management are really statewide issues that we're all struggling with. I think there are a lot of guiding principles that we've found in our listening sessions, our work sessions, and in the report that will at some point address the intent behind coastal zone management. But it's hugely complex splitting out Arctic from Alaska or indigenous from Alaskan. And I think it's complex, it's sensitive. And I think the commission's actually done a good job of approaching this. And I think this listening session only confirms that. I think that it's a great credit to the commission that been really interested in hearing these perspectives and incorporating them into the work that we're doing. So thanks again for everyone who's testimonied today. I testified. I'm working on this. Because it's really helped me in thinking more about how we approach the commission and the commission's end product.
Thank you, Commissioner Andres. And do any of our commissioners on the line have any questions? Try to give a minute to people in case they're trying to unmute their phone. Okay, I am not hearing anyone on the line. And kind of coming back to the sustainable communities, the reason, like I said, I wanted to bring that up is in trying to discuss what it is and what the measurables might be, I think the state could hear more about what we envision that to be and how policy affects that as kind of a how we put together policies that affect our communities and how we go about really ensuring the vision that we've crafted as a commission together. So thank you, Mr. Stotz. You have a comment.
Well, I think you ought to talk to the communities and to talk to the North Slope Borough, the Northwest Arctic Borough, and get your direction from, I think if anybody can give you the best advice, it's the communities themselves. And then I will say another reason that ICC Alaska has hesitated to get too much involved in this commission is that our member organizations are perfectly capable of speaking for themselves. The ASRC, the NANA, the COWERIC, AVCP, they can speak for themselves better than we could speak for them. So, thank you. We are our responsibility at ICC is to tackle the international things on behalf of our people, which means the, you know, the Arctic Council and the UN and the like. But they can. We hesitate to get to do their work for them. It's enough just to try to go to these other things.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment. You said something that just kind of triggered I don't know if it's a memory. I guess it is. I used to think at one point that I knew something about the Arctic than I went to as an inhabitant of the place. And then I went to the Arctic Circle Conference, which really, you know, I had attended Inuit Circumpolar annual, you know, their big meetings a couple times in Greenland and in Kotzebue and in Barrow. But when I went to Iceland, one of the things that struck me was how narrow a view that I had. Because there are countries that aren't even in the Arctic that have developed Arctic policies that are driven by economics. And that really struck me on a couple different fronts, because I realized that there's, when we look at something like shipping and the Bering Straits, those are international waters, and there's not much control. You know, a whole world, global entity is going to be involved in how and regulating how that all works, and made me realize that there's some things we don't have control over that we can ultimately, though, if we choose, make a difference in. But it did force a question to me, and that was, what are the things that we do have control over? And I've really, and I don't know that I have any answers yet. It sure has given me a different way of thinking about the Arctic as it relates to us as inhabitants of our homeland and the future that could be ours. And it is presented with many challenges, but as many opportunities. And thank you for reminding me of that, because, you know, you've had that opportunity to sit at that kind of the international forum. And, you know, when Singapore and Korea and China and all of those countries that have attained observing status to the Arctic Council, you know, they all have Arctic policies. And oftentimes, you know, you talked about being in a rush. And, yeah, I guess we are kind of, because in a wider view, the United States is a little bit behind the eight ball. And the state of Alaska has been kind of addressing some of these issues over a series of commissions, actually, to this point. But, I mean, even in the some of the places that we serve, we are, as elected officials, have a certain time frame in our elected office where I think some of our indigenous people and private industries aren't faced with that kind of pressure. You can have long-term planning. And I think that's what this commission is trying to get beyond, is our and why we have the mix of people that there are there, to be able to get a little bit of immediacy, but also a good look at the long term. Thanks, Jim.
Can I say something, even if I'm not a commissioner? This is Representative Isaacson.
I think you're welcome to. Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. This has been very instructive. I really appreciate the voices that I've been listening to and the viewpoints. And I hear a broad range that strike themes where we know we need to get to a certain point in time, but maybe our path there seems to diverge at times, where we talk about the northern part of the Arctic or the southern part of the state or even other entities involved with the Arctic discussion. And I really appreciate what Reggie was just saying on the idea, you know, that local government sometimes, my summary of what you said on that, Reggie, was that sometimes we get siloed in our discussions. Local government is the best government, it's closest to the people. And so we have an urgency to protect what is local and not to allow an overreach, a tyranny by a, you know, if we're a city government, I was a mayor at one time, I don't want the borough to have an overreaching exercise of authority that is beyond what I believe their purview would be. And if I'm a borough, I don't want the state to reach too far into what I believe is the local borough's responsibility, and the state doesn't want the federal government to overreach. And now, you know, Reggie, you brought up this idea of other nations also looking at the Arctic, and they have long-term plans and visions. And Lisa brought it up, others have brought it up, Jim, the whole host of names. There is opportunity, and there is a lack of control by us. We need to know what's going on, and therefore we need to work together and allow our local silos to merge together as a silo farm, as it were. We've got to find these common interests. I say that because I came up as a Russian linguist. I came up in the Cold War. I was sent here by the Air Force to keep track of what the Soviet Union was doing. So to me, Alaska was always a part of a bigger frontier, a bigger world picture. But I've been here now for 40 years almost, and I very much appreciate Alaska. And I have not, I'm a neophyte, I have not yet plummeted the full fabric, the depth of this wonderful cultural fabric that makes Alaska such an awe-inspiring place, such a wonderful place to be in, and yet at the same time such a frustrating place to be, because we can each one see where we need to go, and yet we want to protect certain interests. So, for example, trying to take the railroad from Fairbanks to Dead Horse, and Benny, Representative Nagyak, of course, said, yeah, I want that railroad to continue on to the coal mines so that there's opportunity up there. And people, you know, fighting the idea, well, should we do this? And it would open up opportunity for not only shale exploration on the North Slope, the Brooks Range,
But it would also open up opportunity in the Ambler Mining District, as condensate could then be backhauled on the railroad, or limestone out of Livengood to allow for creation of our own cement to build hydroelectric dams such as Susitna or Watonna, and other things like this. You know, it would create jobs. But then different folks fight against the idea that, well, we want jobs. We need to have jobs, but we're going to protect what kind of jobs? And yet, I really appreciate what Jim said. The resources, even in the Alaska Constitution, the resources are first reserved to those who are similarly situated in proximity to the resource, because we're to encourage the settlement of the land. That's the state of Alaska's Constitution. Do all communities survive? No. In Fairbanks area alone, we've had communities that disappear. We've had Olness Pond had 3,000 people during the turn of the last century, during our gold rush. Today it's a park. Chena, the community of Chena, was on the confluence of the Tanana and the Chena rivers, at one time larger than the city of Fairbanks, and it's gone today. It's a park. Much of it, you couldn't tell it even existed. Communities come and go. We're not to, as a state, we're mandated not to make sure that all communities survive, but we are to encourage the settlement of the land and the development of the resources with the idea of conservation, with the idea of maximum use, maximum benefit. And maximum benefit can't be, this is, I think, Jim's comment, state policy is sometimes selfish, because we look at it in terms of maximum benefit to the people is translated as maximum dollars to the state treasury, and then we dole it out according to the population, whoever gets the most votes, and that is a selfish way of doing it. Maximum benefit to people must mean, in my interpretation of the of this discussion and our Constitution, it has to mean that the money stays in the community as much as possible first to help develop an infrastructure that will encourage a whole range of jobs, a diversification of jobs, whether it's manufacturing a local resource or extracting it, or all the associated jobs that spring up once you leverage one opportunity for another. So as we discuss sustainability and sustainable communities, I would hope that the conversation could really cut its teeth also on the concept of, if a local community refuses private investment, does the state have a moral obligation to give other people's money, public money, to sustain it? It goes back to the idea of local government. Can we, in fact, encourage the enterprise that our people are capable of in whatever community we live, whether it's North Pole or Barrow or wherever? Can we encourage that and make that a possibility, or are we going to allow a few people to say no, and especially if those voices are not in our local community and don't have a stake in our future and aren't going to be there to support us in our old age and retirement? They're not going to bring a bag of food to us because they may live even in another state. So where do we go as a state when we talk about our resource development, when we talk about connecting our communities with energy pathways, with transportation corridors, with the ability to have intrastate, intercommunity commerce, let alone interstate or international commerce? And we're capable. We've mentioned the Northern Sea Route, the Northwest Passage, and so forth, the need for Arctic ports, but we haven't talked about connecting those Arctic ports to a rail or something, so that, let's say, just for the sake, whether it's Port Clarence or Port Blossom, whichever one, if we want to protect our fishing grounds and so forth, why not make sure that those ships transit the shortest possible route? So if they're coming over Russia, the Northern Sea Route, They stop at one of our Alaska ports, and they offload cargo destined for the North American continent there at that Northern Arctic route, rather than another couple of weeks of transit through our fishing grounds and through our shallow, fragile waters, where we know oil spills are going to come from the vessels more than from the exploration. Is this wrong? Am I saying it wrong? I could be wrong, but why not connect North America through Alaska and then turn those ships around? Those are some of the opportunities. But I wanted to inject that because as a legislator, it goes back to Reggie's comment, we've got a short life as a legislator. And so one of the comments was, let's do things not in a rush, not half-baked, but at the same time, we want to make sure that we are providing the right leadership on an elected level. So I just wanted to throw that out because these are things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to be able to perk them, have them percolate with this group because, again, I'm not in the Arctic, but I'm an Arctic citizen because I'm a state resident and I'm very concerned about our state. So I just wanted to inject that, and I'd be grateful for any feedback.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions from the commission?
No questions, just a quick comment. And Representative Isaacson, I think you hit the nail on the head in some regards, and that is with some of the development that occurs in and has occurred actually through the history of Alaska and rural areas. It's the getting into the question of what's in it for us, and also that sometimes being overlooked because of the cost-benefit analysis in the fact that we might be small populations. And some of the cost for building some of that infrastructure is very high. And so, you know, being able to have a little bit more of a discussion on how all that occurs looking forward, you know. So appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. We have about 35 minutes left, and I really appreciate everyone who's called in and been in the room and been patient for discussion. So wasn't sure if there's anyone else in the audience who would like to come up and make comments or discuss anything with the commission or on the line. Everyone's hungry. Okay. Okay. Well, if there are no other comments or anyone else who'd like to provide comments here in person or online, I think we are prepared to close out. Looking with other commissioners, they're all giving me a nod. I really want to thank everyone who came today to listen in and those who participated in discussion with the commission. Your comments are very helpful to us in our work, and please keep an eye out for more events on our website. Just Google Alaska Arctic Policy Commission. If you have any questions for us as commissioners or Nikush, who is our executive director, will be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel like we should clap. I really think the legislature needs clapping.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for everyone online. Have a good day.
Thanks.
Bye. Thanks to Liz and Reggie.
It has nothing to do with the content and more about... Oh, God, this isn't going to make me any friends.
No.